Okay, well, I'm here today on the ASI cast with David Raybould of TRP, and we're going to have a conversation about all things SVOD, subscription VOD, and a few related topics. But firstly, David, for listeners who may not have come across TRP, can you tell us about what you specialise in?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and thank you very much for having me on your podcast. Appreciate it. TRP is a UK-based media research agency. And our work spans the UK and the US. Roughly half of our work comes from the UK. And we do work with most of the broadcasters in the UK. So our client base, our heartland client base is broadcasters, content distributors, rights owners. And we've probably got four specialisms. Reporting, like on secondary data sources like Barb and Nielsen data. Creating content metadata via our recording capability. So we can curate content attributes, the repeat status, production company, country of origin, and so on. And originating new data, promo logs, whistle-to-whistle data, and anything which you can get off screen. So, for example, counting the number of times alcohol is in use. We do strategy work, mainly around promo and media planning. And we do measurement. So we run four different panels, three in the UK and one for RT in Ireland.
Well, we're very keen to talk to you because we often speak to a lot of people on the podcast who are either involved in producing content and trying to persuade advertisers to advertise during it, or those responsible for measuring that content. But you're very much at the other end of the system, analysing what comes out and trying to work out what it actually means for your clients. And I think today, our main focus is to chat about insights from the SVOD survey that you operate. How did this survey come into being and what gap did you see it filling in the market?
So it came out of two of our core competences, the ability to measure audiences and our content warehouse, which is a complete catalogue of all the content in the UK and including on Netflix, Amazon Prime, Apple and Disney. And so Sky, one of our long-term clients, challenged us to put those two things together to create granular measurement of content on those platforms on a daily basis. So we're aiming at two fundamental objectives or trying to fill two specific gaps. Granular measurement of SVOD content down to the series and episode level across all devices, and also to identify and quantify all TV viewing that Barb can't identify, what Barb would call unmatched. So we spent around 6 months refining that survey and technique with Sky. And we've now been generating data on a like-for-like basis consistently across the last 12 months. Mm.
So it's a UK-based survey currently filling a gap in the UK market's understanding of what's going on, with Sky being the initial client. How are you gathering the data? What's the mechanism by which you actually measure SVOD?
So it's a daily online survey, which we run ourselves, generates around 2,100 responses. And we ask participants for what they watched yesterday. The specific innovation that made it possible was that we found a way to fuse our content warehouse with our survey tool. So when we put the question to participants, we present a searchable database of content that they might have watched on Netflix or Amazon Prime or the other services. And that was tricky because it's relatively straightforward for anyone who uses Excel or databases frequently to be able to manipulate a tool in the survey to find a particular entry in the database. But for most participants, that's quite hard. So it took a while to train respondents in how to use that tool so that they could identify the exact thing that was watched. So that was the biggest challenge that we faced when we developed the service. We also, once we've identified what content was being watched, we asked people a series of questions to qualify it. So where were you? So we're picking up viewing that's in-home, but also in other places. When was it? So time and date, obviously. What people liked or didn't like. What device was in use, and if it was the TV set, how it got to the TV screen, so via an inbuilt app or by being cast or by Sky Q, for example. And we asked people about a range of media consumption, as well as asking, we call the first part of the bottom-up survey, where we're recording data at the very granular level, but we also ask about overall media consumption from the top-down perspective, so that we can create multi-platform data from a single source. So we asked about live, box sets, on-demand viewing, and so on. And when we've done that, we stick it together and create Barb style metrics. So that our survey produces answers which you'd recognize as thousands or reach or share. And in our case, like for like share, because we use Barb data to model all the unmatched that we don't know.
And is the universe people who have got some form of SFOD, or is it the everyone?
It's actually two panels kind of stuck together. There's 1,500 participants who have SFOD, and there's 500 who don't have SFOD. The first part's used to get the granular data on SFOD, and the second part's used to get totals so that we can create a total audience for all those different types of TV activity, whether it's SFOD or whether it's some other kind of activity. So
in terms of them having access to SFOD, do they have to pay for it themselves? I mean, I've seen some trackers claim that up to 20% of users are actually using logins from outside the household. Are they included, or are they...
So it's a panel of individuals, and we ask whether people have access to SFOD.
Okay.
We did an ad hoc project about 3 months ago where we looked at the way that people access. So we know for each participant whether they pay themselves, whether they piggyback off somebody else's subscription, like my children, or whether there are some people in kind of syndicates or clubs where they contribute an amount to a person who pays the bill to Netflix. Mm-hmm. So we know about the way that payment is made, but sometimes you could say that you had access to SFOD even if you never subscribed. So after lockdown, if you came around to my house and you watched something on Netflix, you would say that you had access to SFOD, you watched something on SFOD, although you've never paid for that. And we would capture that viewing as well, because it's not a homes-based survey, it's an individuals-based survey.
And you mentioned your content warehouse. How is that maintained? What's the data source for that? It sounds quite a useful asset to have.
That's actually one of the deliverables of the project, that the content warehouse itself is a data asset, and our team curates that effectively manually. So Netflix are not shy about explaining what content is on air, and our database will have content that hasn't yet aired. So the team take a production first approach. And when we know about the thing that's being produced, it gets born into our content warehouse. Mm-hmm. And when we find out which service is broadcast on, we tag it with where it was that it aired or was broadcast. So we typically update that daily. So each day the survey only includes content that was possible to watch on that day.
And do you collect, there's been talk of Brideshead Revisited coming back, and the number of people at the time, I think ITV did a survey after it went out, and the majority of people thought it went out on BBC because it was a BBC sort of programme that they expected to see there. Does your data collection effectively allow people to be mistaken? So if someone says, I watch Stranger Things on Amazon Prime, do you let them say that, or does it beep and say, don't be silly?
It's not possible to say that in the survey tool, since we know when content is aired on different platforms. Mm. So you couldn't tell our survey that you watch Stranger Things on Amazon Prime. But there is a question at the end, which is, did you find everything you wanted to find in the database? Mm. So typically a respondent will say yes. About 9 or 10% of the time, they say no, and they tell us about a program they couldn't find. And sometimes, especially when the service was in its rollout stage, they would find some content that we hadn't got in our database because it wasn't complete yet, and so we'd add it. More often than not, they try and tell us that they watched EastEnders on Netflix, and we know that they didn't. So we discount that answer.
Mm. Now, at the ISI, over the last few years, we've been getting missives from the frontline in the US, from Nielsen and Brian Fuhrer, about what they've been seeing with their electronic measurement of Netflix, Amazon Prime consumption in the US. And it's been really interesting, but we've kind of taken it as face value that must be similar to what happens in other markets. So it's interesting to understand what insights you're seeing specifically from the UK market, which I suspect may be similar, but won't be identical, because every country's got its own quirks, its own mix of state broadcasting and commercial broadcasting, etc.
And the UK is special outside the US in that we have a really advanced production sector. So original content on SFOD services, even global SFOD services, I would be amazed if the UK didn't perform well on a local basis and internationally. So the first thing that we're seeing is, as you mentioned, the metadata itself is a product. So one thing we've noticed is shorter series runs across the last couple of years or so. The average strict scripted drama on Netflix has come down from nearly 10 episodes to around 8 episodes. And I think that's because of the way that people interact with Netflix and the way that people value themselves their own subscription. So, for example, if you watched 10 series that had 8 episodes or 8 series that had 10 episodes, that might cost the same to produce, but you'd probably value the 10 series more because you'd feel that you've got more benefit or more utility. So viewers are measuring content in lumps, which is different from linear, I think. We're seeing some interesting data at the very headline level. So we've got The Stranger as the most viewed new series since December 19. And if we scooped up all the audiences that we measured for that series, we'd have an audience of at least 10 million. So the biggest thing we're seeing on SVOD is about the same size as the really big thing would get on traditional or terrestrial TV. Mm. This week, about 3 million people have started to watch The Crown, Series 4, so far. About half of those have seen 4 episodes or more, and 500,000 have completed the series so far. So we're beginning to see how a series grows across time. It isn't a once-and-done exercise. We're able to look at content that's dropped on a once-and-done basis versus content that's launched episodically. So Picard, for example, Picard, the Star Trek spin-off on Amazon Prime, had about the same audience as the Stranger after 1 week, but Picard was episodic, so it had lots of first weeks, and in the end, the Stranger achieved more than twice the audience. So it looks like the episodic replicating the linear broadcast schedule doesn't do any favours for consumption, overall consumption on SVOD services, as far as we can see in our data. In fact, it looks quite a lot lower.
There's an interesting couple of points there. In kind of reverse order, there's also a hybrid approach that Apple have used, and I know that Amazon Prime are going to use for The Expanse in December, which is to drop the first 4 episodes straight away and then go episodic. That they want people to get hooked. That one episode on its own, an orphan episode like Picard, I did watch it and it was very frustrating because you just were getting into it and then it's like, see you next week.
And anecdotally, we see that in the verbatims as well, coming from Picard in particular, but also nearly every episodically dropped major show has got some level of complaint about that exact thing. Yeah. I think 4 could be the magic number. I mentioned that 4 is the number at the moment where there's a definite cliff edge in the Crown viewing. Yeah. So there are people, and that's only been on air, well, probably less than a fortnight, isn't it? So 4 could be a magic number. I don't really see any benefit in stopping it after 4 and then going episodic. We could run that. I haven't actually run that specific analysis, but my hunch would be you feel that you're in control, and then suddenly you're not in control, and that's more frustrating than it is anticipation building.
I'd be interested to see what research they were basing that on in terms of why they decided to do that. Often they haven't got the choice because if they are buying up US network TV series, they have to be, you know, things like The Good Place and Brooklyn Nine-Nine have to be released at the pace that the broadcasters in the States.
Exactly. There's also one thing which people do, which you couldn't do in the episodic model, which is watch the last episode first. So we first saw this in the data about 6 months ago. We thought this is a mistake or something's wrong here. Why would you watch the last episode first? So we looked into that more, and I think what's happening is that there's a segment of people, not a tiny segment of people, who enjoy watching the last episode first. It's like reading the last page of a book first to see what happens. Mm. And there seems to be two categories of shows. Shows where if the last episode has a higher audience than the previous episodes, on a temporary basis, that could be a good thing. Mm. In other words, anticipation for the end, wanting to know what happens. On a long-term basis, it's a bad thing, because it means that people are watching the last episode and then not going back to watch the other episodes. So a new metric, is the audience for the last show higher than the audience for the 3 preceding the last show? And of course we can measure that on day one, and some series have an immediate boost at the end and some don't. And how that changes over time is beginning to tell us something about what the audience thinks about the programme.
I think if a lot of people had seen the last episode of Lost first, they'd have never started watching it.
Lost was one of the most frustrating TV shows in history, wasn't it? Yeah.
I mean, it's intriguing your point about the 10-8 episode series being perceived to deliver more consumer value than 8-10 episode series. Yeah. Because, of course, that has cost implications, because the reason why Big Bang Theory and most American network sitcoms for the last 50 years have had 22 episodes is because your setup costs, the actors, the setup, make it much more cost effective to churn out loads of episodes. And it was only really when HBO came along with things like The Sopranos and had 10 or 12 episode runs that people started to think you can get better quality. But of course, it is more expensive. Does that skew the advantage even more towards the global players who can do something like, you know, a 6-episode run of a drama about chess, and then leave it at that.
Absolutely. And the other factor that's, I think, driving it is the model of subscriptions. So if you're a broadcaster, you want 26 or 36 or 46 episodes of a hit show because we're driving commercial eyeballs. But Netflix aren't trying to do that. They're trying to generate subscriptions. So how Netflix value consumption or attention might be quite different from how a linear ad-funded broadcaster might value it. And that, I think, would put downward pressure on the number of eps in a series.
Mm. It's we're talking on Zoom, and it's interesting, over the last 9 months, it's gone from no one having heard of it to it almost being used as a generic when people talk about, I was on Zoom, and often they're not. They might be on Teams or some other product. Netflix has obviously had a similar experience, in the sense that people, you know, Netflix and chill, and people referring generally to Netflix as almost like a way of watching television. But is it as dominant in the UK, at least, as people assume, in terms of versus the other suppliers? What I mean, I don't know if you calculate share, but certainly is it, are Amazon Prime way behind, or is it a bit more competitive than we think?
There's no doubt, looking at the data, that Netflix is the biggest, most dominant SVOD platform in the UK. I'd have no hesitation about saying that. But it's not astronomically overwhelmingly dominant. So we would estimate about a third, or perhaps 30%, of all bar unmatched viewing is actually to Netflix. But YouTube, we would say, is about the same size as Netflix overall, albeit two-thirds of that viewing does not happen on the TV set. So Netflix is a lot bigger than YouTube on the television, but not bigger than Netflix as measured in total consumption across all devices. Amazon Prime, smaller again, but of the order of a third or a half the size of Netflix. But other activities are also big. So Barb would categorise the TV being paused, or viewers searching for content, or gaming, all as being unmatched. And they're not small chunks in the total picture for unmatched.
Does Amazon Prime suffer slightly, do you think, from the fact that it's bundled? In other words, there are other motivations for having Amazon Prime other than getting the video, and that there may be people who just don't get near the video because they've got it for the home delivery, whereas Netflix quite clearly only does one thing. So therefore, if you're subscribing to Netflix, you are probably going to try it out.
Netflix is quite clearly television. It's a fundamentally television service. Well, actually, not everybody on your survey last week agreed with that statement.
No.
Which really, really surprised me, because from a viewer perspective, Netflix is clearly television, in my view. Amazon Prime, or Amazon Prime Video, is less television than that, because for the reason that you said. So I would be amazed if the Netflix reach among its universe was not higher than the Amazon Prime reach among its technical universe.
Yeah.
And not least, it's slightly harder to access overall still, I think. And because of the other motivations to have Amazon Prime in the first place. I definitely agree with that.
And the main motivation for Amazon in having a video service is actually to draw people in, to lock them into having home delivery. That's where the money's made. I mean, that's there in the same way that BT Sport is there to underpin BT's broadband empire, as opposed to necessarily as purely a source of advertising revenue.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. I think that's right. And I think that's probably why Netflix is the go-to. Netflix is the Zoom of the VOD world, or it's the Hoover of the home cleaning world. It's the brand name and also the catch-all name for that kind of activity. I totally agree, yeah.
Now, one thing that at our conference, Glance, who used to be called Medimetria, Eurodata Worldwide, who track audiences around the world, picked up was that broadcaster VOD services had also benefited from the strange times that we're in. Have you noticed any general changes as a result of the pandemic in terms of volume of listening and share of volume of viewing and share of viewing amongst your respondents?
Absolutely, yes. And we can pick up BVOD and other forms of catch-up at a very top-line level from our survey, but we aren't separately identifying content on BVOD because other services are capable of doing that. And we're also measuring YouTube at a category and subcategory level, so we can see some changes over time. And we've got we would estimate around 20% more Netflix viewing and exactly the same amount more of Amazon Prime viewing during the hard lockdown, lockdown one in the spring and early summer. And the interesting thing is that the Netflix viewing went back to normal again and the Amazon Prime viewing didn't. So Prime seemed to have a permanent boost and Netflix had only a temporary boost. Yeah. And I think that might be to do with the other thing we saw was that the depth of exploration of content changed quite significantly. So we saw a lot more number of things being consumed on both services from the panel than before, as people start to exhaust the things that they obviously want to watch and start looking around for new things they might not have thought about before to watch. So the dearth of content, I think, benefited SVOD services quite significantly. But Amazon Prime more so than Netflix, in that they seem to have held on to most of their gains that they made in lockdown.
That's interesting. It might relate back to what we were just discussing, because obviously Netflix publicised the big spike they had in new subscriptions as a result of the pandemic, whereas with Amazon Prime, it may have been people who already subscribed but hadn't really tried it yet.
I think that's absolutely right. We could look at that by looking at some reach metrics as well, but I think that's a pretty good explanation, yeah.
So it's interesting, you're obviously been focused on SVOD. Your wider business is very much about analysing how people watch television. Do you think the growth of SVOD and also broadcaster VOD have got wider implications for how we typically analyse and report the lifestyle of all programmes, not just SVOD programmes, the life cycle of broadcast programmes?
I would say absolutely yes. The nature of SVOD lends itself to more dynamic metrics. So there is no such thing as the final audience estimate for a particular piece of content because it just keeps growing incrementally. So what becomes really interesting is to look at the speed of the changes of those metrics or dynamic metrics. So for example, take Stranger Things. If we looked at how long it took viewers to find the first series of Stranger Things, it's probably quite a long time, maybe 3 or 6 months. How long it took them to find the second series, maybe 1 month. How long to find the third series, maybe less than a week. So looking at changes in those metrics over time or series on series changes can definitely help us understand how viewers are relating to and interacting to content. And another thing that we see is that different shows build at different rates. So Tiger King had a really slow start, but I think it was a bit of a surprise hit. And it suddenly gained momentum, went viral, and suddenly put on audience between the third and the sixth week, which is really unusual for a new series launch. Even on Netflix, we seem to see most audience coming fairly soon. However, even though we see the largest overall weeks being early on, that viewing keeps going for a long time. So only a fifth of the audience to The Witcher, for example, came in the first week. Most of it comes not in the first week. So in the traditional TV world, almost none of it would be in the overnight, as we call it at the moment. So one of the things we've tried to do is to reapply some of those dynamic metrics back to linear TV and recreate them and see how they look. So not just taking the first showing or first airing of a piece of content, but tracking it over its life and stitching it all back together again.
Have you got any idea from those analyses? I'm guessing you may have done them for the BBC, and obviously I don't want you to talk about things that aren't public domain, but the practice of putting box sets up before something is broadcast, which the BBC have done a few, I think they did it first with Car Share, but more recently with a lot of BBC Three series. Does that have the ability to kind of build a word of mouth that drives people back to the linear broadcast? How do they sit together, do you think?
Well, that's what Barb would call non-linear, I guess, where there isn't a linear transmission to put an audience back to, and that data set's available through Barb data. One of the things we're doing is starting to deliver content-centric reporting rather than linear or time period-centric reporting, where we do stitch that back together. At the moment, those slices are still really small. So there are very few programmes that have got a really big non-linear or pre-TX size audience compared to what they go on and achieve later, because there isn't much time between the pre-TX and the TX. There's loads more time between the TX and after the TX, so infinitely more time. Mm. And so building audiences where audiences accumulate and accumulate and accumulate, and looking at the speed at which the audiences build seems the most interesting way that we've been able to look at the data so far.
Mm. Finally, how can people access the data that you've been talking about. I gather for the first year it was a survey you did exclusively for Sky, but is it more widely available now? Can people subscribe to it?
It is, yes. You're right that for the first year, Sky was our client in this product. And now we're moving to make it a syndicated research project under the brand name Codex, TRP Codex. So we've launched a syndicated tariff last week. Subscriptions are available, and there's a two-part subscription rate card. Organisations pay a fee to subscribe depending on the size and nature of the organisation, and data access fees depending on the depth and frequency and granularity needed. So, for example, a production company might want to look at just their programme, but a linear broadcaster might want a kind of deeper and broader view as to the nature of all the viewing, not just their one programme. So, yes, subscribers are welcome. You can see on our website there's a rate card to download if you look there. And we're now in the process of signing up subscribers starting in 2021.
Okay, well, we'll put a link in the show notes to the website if anyone's interested in following that up with you. But it certainly sounds like something we'll probably pop back in a year or two and find out how the trends that you've been looking at continue to develop, because we'll be presumably seeing a longer term impact of things like Disney Plus on the market. And then also the interesting phenomenon of potential content shortages as production's been halted in quite a lot of areas, which may have some time lag. So we'd be interested to see what impact that has as well. But in the meantime, it's been really great to talk to you. So thanks for making the time, David, and we'll speak to you soon.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks.